So I'll be talking a little bit about a study that we're conducting right now on assessing and trying to promote adaptation to climate change in rural and isolated communities in Alaska. I'm not going to download that file to PDF right now. I have no relationships to disclose. As those of you who have had an opportunity to review the abstract for this paper know, I have three objectives. I'd like to talk a little bit about how a community-based sentinel surveillance system was implemented in rural and frontier communities in Alaska, to explain how these results were collected, and then finally to identify how the adaptations that resulted from this process are being implemented across the state. Those of you who have been working in the area of climate change and health have no doubt seen this report before. I just simply want to highlight one component of the report that I feel is important. When we talk about assessing or adapting to climate change, especially as it relates to health, the vulnerability of the community residents is an important characteristic. In other words, the same level of climate change in one population would result in very few health outcomes, adverse health outcomes, that is, whereas in another population that is more vulnerable, you could see extraordinarily significant adverse health outcomes. Vulnerability is distinct from susceptibility, and you can see the two definitions here. The final statement in the report that I'd like to highlight is that data to support a broad understanding of which populations will be most susceptible and vulnerable to diseases affected by climate change are generally lacking at this time. And that's really the overarching goal for this study, was to try and conduct research amongst the residents of rural and isolated frontier communities in the state of Alaska, because we feel that they are highly susceptible to climate change. Specifically, we wanted to know, what are the adverse health outcomes and how should we assess them? Among what populations should these data be collected? And most importantly, how can we prevent them by promoting adaptation at community settings? So here's what we know right now in the state of Alaska. We know that there are significant regional effects of climate change across the state. And we know that those effects are having an impact on health in communities. But we don't know exactly how much or to what extent. In fact, there's a paucity of research on the health impacts of many of the environmental changes that we're seeing across the state right now. I'd like to point out very briefly on the map of Alaska that you see here that there are really three distinct ecotones as it relates to climate change in the state. We have the northern and western boundaries, the maritime regions of the state, which are in many cases places in which people have been making a living off the sea, either from seafood or from harvesting large aquatic mammals, whales and walruses and such, using sea ice, shore-fast sea ice during the winters. We have a large swath of the interior of the state in which residents have been living in close harmony with large populations of ungulates, mostly caribou and moose, who travel in a normal migration pattern that has been established for centuries, and so they've established their own lifestyles and their own subsistence patterns based on that calendar. And then finally, we have what's referred to as the banana belt of Alaska, which is the temperate rainforest of southeastern Alaska, the panhandle. And in that area, many of the residents who are living also in maritime communities are living off of seafood harvested from the local ocean, either in the form of salmon or from kelp and other sources of aquatic foods. And so as you might imagine, in each one of these regions, there are slight differences in terms of how it is that climate change is affecting them. And so you can see that in the northern sections of the coastal areas, where there used to be shore-fast ice that protected those regions from large storms, as that shore-fast ice is less and less prevalent during the year and is less thick, even in the height of the winter, there is greater erosion of coastlines. And so you're seeing entire communities falling into the ocean. We're seeing changes in animal behavior, specifically when whales are moving up and down the coast and where they're moving. Thawing permafrost. And when the permafrost thaws, it's interesting, if when you visit these communities, you'll see that in most cases, most of these villages are built right on permafrost, and the permafrost has never melted, and so as a consequence, people hadn't realized the extent to which many of the infrastructural components of their village are built literally on ice. And so as that ice begins to melt, the water plant falls into holes, the water sources, the tundra ponds that they use for drinking water, literally disappear overnight, the way if you pull a plug on a bathtub, the water just swirls away. And as that permafrost disappears, these effects are having a huge, as you might imagine, huge impacts on these communities. In the interior portions of the state, as a consequence of changes in climate, we're seeing extremely fast melting of winter snows. Usually what would happen is over the course of the entire summer, those snows would melt very gradually, and the water would actually provide a resource for salmon to spawn into the interior sections of the state. It would provide a way for people to travel back and forth between their villages. But as a consequence of rising heat, these snow patches are melting quickly. So you're seeing flooding in the springtime and a huge erosion, and then wind-blown dust storms in the interior, which in some cases cause people to have to stay indoors and wear respirators when they travel out. And secondly, it also leads to drought. And so we're seeing large forest fires, which cause smoke, which drift across these communities. And finally, down in the southeastern portion of the state that I just mentioned, we're seeing a northern expansion of invasive species. There's a lot of algal blooms and other types of problems, such as paralytic shellfish poisoning and amnesic shellfish poisoning, which haven't been prevalent, haven't been endemic to the state, and now are becoming far more common. And finally, once again, we're seeing changes in fish and animal behavior. The salmon are spawning at different times of the year. People have to try and figure out when they can go out and procure food for their families. So here's what we were faced with. I don't think it's any surprise that in the previous presentation, when we saw those data, those national secondary data, Alaska was not represented. Alaska has very little secondary data available for us in terms of how it is that we conduct our surveillance. So as a consequence, we have to collect it ourselves. And one of the ways that we felt that we could begin to understand the health effects of climate change in the state of Alaska was by the development and implementation of a community-based sentinel surveillance system. There's really not a whole lot of literature on how to set one of these things up. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that throughout the presentation. But specifically, there were two reasons that we selected this type of a mechanism, this type of a surveillance system. First, they're really effective in helping to understand the mechanisms between less understood or certainly less recorded challenge to health and health impacts at the community level, because there's no secondary data being collected. As you might imagine, and people live in communities in which there isn't a hospital, maybe there isn't a clinical facility at all, you're not going to be getting a lot of secondary data from reportable and notifiable disease systems. And then secondly, when people travel to urban hubs or peri-urban communities for care, that's where it's geocoded. And so you don't find out where it is that they actually encountered this health problem. You find out that it happened in Anchorage. And so for those two reasons, we really felt like it was important for us to try and do something more community-based. I'm sorry for how hard this is to read. I just want to kind of very briefly say that this really required an interdisciplinary study team. So we had to have social scientists and public health scientists working together to develop and implement this kind of a design, because in one case, we needed to work with our public health experts to identify the metrics, to develop the instrument, to figure out how to field it, basically how to conduct a sentinel surveillance system. But at the same time, we needed social scientists who could identify and engage stakeholders in the community, who could have those stakeholders participate in a meaningful way in determining how best to implement this work, and then finally, to assess their preferences so that we could develop adaptation strategies that would actually be actionable, be workable on the ground in these communities. So here's how we did it very briefly. About 3 years ago, October 7th and 8th of 2010, there was a climate change and health colloquium held in Anchorage, Alaska, in which we brought in representatives of a number of different state, local, federal, and international agencies who are working in climate change. We also brought in residents of communities across the state. And over the course of that meeting, we reviewed both the secondary literature as it relates to what were the likely health effects of climate change in rural and isolated communities in the state, and also we heard members of the communities themselves present on their experiences and provided some local knowledge about the kinds of things that they've been seeing just over the course of the past few decades. And as a consequence of those discussions, we identified four broad domains for research as it relates to a sentinel surveillance system on the climate change of health. The first one had to do with environmental changes themselves, because in some cases, we're not collecting that data either. And so we needed to have local members of the communities tell us, you know, based upon their experiences and what they know to be normal climactic patterns in their community at certain times of the year, what's happening that's unusual? What's abnormal? What are they seeing that's really different from what has been happening in the past? Secondly, we wanted to know what effects are they having on hunting and harvesting behaviors? Because in most cases, these are communities that are still practicing subsistence lifestyles. And so they would be able to tell us in great detail, what does this mean for the behavior of the plants and animals upon which we subsist? The third broad category was food and water safety. So in some cases, in Alaska, as a consequence of the normal routines in which both plants and animals and fish occur in the environment, we need to store them for extraordinarily long periods of time. So we can harvest them in the fall, in the summer and fall, but then we have to figure out a way to keep these things so that we can store them and eat them throughout the winter and spring. The spring in Alaska, by the way, is known as the starving time for most of the residents, because that's when you begin to run out of the stuff, or the things that you've been storing have gone bad. And so as a consequence, we were very interested in knowing to what extent are people able to store foods using traditional techniques. And then finally and fourthly, a broad domain had to do with general health and air quality. What are some of the things that people are experiencing, either in their households or themselves, as it relates to a syndrome? We were looking for specific just syndromes of health outcomes that people were experiencing, respiratory problems, digestive problems, unintentional injuries, those sorts of things. So here's what we ended up doing. We identified communities across the state. So I identified communities in the far northwestern portions of the state, in the maritime region that we talked about earlier, in the interior portion of the state, and then communities in the southeast portion, in the panhandle. We developed a survey which consisted of 33 structured questions with ordinal categories of responses and one large open-ended question at the end that asked, is there anything else that you want to tell us? And we provided that survey monthly to residents of these communities, and they provided us their responses in three different ways, either via the web, they sent us through snail mail, or they could call us and we'd walk them through the survey ourselves and complete it for them. I'd like to point out as well, just the sheer scope here, Point Hope and Ketchikan are nearly 2,000 miles apart, so it's a pretty broad sweep in terms of the study area that we're talking about. So for example, this is the community of Kivalina. Kivalina is about 374 primarily Inupiaq residents who live on an island in the Chukchi Sea on the northwestern coast of the state of Alaska. Kivalina is an interesting community in that it is literally daily at battle with the ocean to try and maintain its presence. Most models suggest the Kivalina will be gone by 2025, and the community is currently attempting to figure out where and how to go about moving and whether they can get any assistance either from the state or the federal government to do so. And so we went to Kivalina. I took this photo in the spring. I've also visited it in the winter when it's completely ice-locked. There's shore-fast ice that extends dozens and sometimes hundreds of miles out into the Chukchi Sea. And it's interesting to consider because when that ice exists, Kivalina is connected to Sweden. People can travel on that shore-fast ice all around the circumpolar north. And so it's a really interesting, when you think about the community that exists in the circumpolar regions, Kivalina is a perfect example of that kind of connection, and that kind of interconnected culture. And we went to these communities and we worked with local tribal leaders, with healthcare providers, and in this case, in Kivalina, we specifically reached out to subsistence leaders such as whaling captains. Kivalina still practices whaling, where they subsist off the bowhead whale. So they'll send teams out on the ice and watch for the blow spouts, and when they see them, they'll drop the old skin boats in and row out and harpoon the whale and then drag it ashore and process it right there in the village. And so we have whaling captains who are participating in this study telling us about some of their experiences as part of their subsistence activities. Just as a contrast, this is the village of Angoon. Angoon has about 450 Tlingit residents. This is in the southeastern portion of the state, about 1,100 miles away. This is a temperate rainforest. These people practice a similar subsistence activity. They don't necessarily whale as often as the folks in Kivalina, but they'd be happy to take a whale if one presented itself. They primarily subsist on salmon and on deer, which will come down off the mountains and down to the coast in the wintertime, and they'll harvest them then. And so it's interesting to consider some of the commonalities and differences in these communities as we began collecting our data. And here's how we did it. We have a purposive sample of study participants, about 91 individuals across these communities. As you can see, a pretty good age pattern in that we wanted to try and ensure that we had residents who could speak knowledgeably about previous events. They knew about what the climate had been like in their communities and could talk about differences over time. We also did we were very careful in trying to maintain a fairly representative percentage of demographic equation across the community so that the number of Alaska Native participants is fairly consistent with how it actually exists in these regions of the state. One other thing that I should point out here is that we were very careful as well to try and maintain a constant population, and we didn't actually lose any participants. In fact, we added participants over the year that we were collecting these surveillance data because it's just so important to the members of the communities. So most of you are probably familiar with the concept of an odds ratio, so I'm not going to walk through how to go about developing one. I will just point out very briefly that we had two exposure questions that we asked at the beginning of the survey that I wanted to talk about. The first exposure question is, in the past 30 days, how often has the weather seemed very different from what you or people you know in the community expect for this time of year? And we're really asking people here to pull upon their local knowledge. What's it like at this time of year usually, and how is this different? And you should see some of the responses that we have to that open-ended question at the end of the survey, because people told us some amazing stories about what things were like for years and years in their community, and now it's just completely different. And the second exposure question that we ask is, in the past 30 days, how often have you or people you know in the community changed when and how you travel as a result of unusual weather? We ask this question because, as I mentioned earlier, many of these communities are linked in the winter, especially as a consequence of the presence of shore-fast ice, and so there's a great deal of travel in the winter. And that's when a lot of unintentional injuries happen, because people are traveling hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles in extraordinarily difficult conditions, and sudden winter storms or other events that they may not have expected at this time of year can catch them unawares. And so we wanted to know whether or not travel patterns have changed, because in most cases, these communities have to travel to adapt and subsist on the environment. And here's what we found. The only outcome that we couldn't model as a consequence of a relatively low number was paralytic shellfish poisoning events. We only had 10 PSP reports in the full year that we collected these data. I should point out that 10 is actually a pretty big number because of the severity of this illness. It's just that we couldn't model it for these numbers, for these analyses. I just want to touch very briefly on a few of the significant numbers. Basically, what we did here with the odds ratio was we assessed the odds of a specific health outcome happening in communities which experienced one or both of the exposures that I just described to you compared to communities that didn't experience those exposures on a monthly basis. In one case, we actually looked at it clustered by region rather than by community. But ultimately, as you can see here, we've demonstrated that there are some rather extraordinarily associations between some of these exposures and some health outcomes. There's nearly a 3 times increase in people experiencing reduced water security when they've had to change their travel plans. And that's because in some communities, they actually travel to get their water. And so when the events, when climate events reduce their ability to travel, and perhaps because of storms or other hardships, they couldn't go get water. So water security in these communities was much reduced. Food security, you can see, is highly associated with unusual weather over the course of the past 30 days. Hypothermia increased nearly fivefold when people had to change their travel plans, and that's because they were traveling new routes or traveling at different times than they were normally would do so. And so as a consequence, they didn't have a, there was no cultural model for them. They didn't know exactly what to expect and how to adapt to that situation. Frostbite, and perhaps the most significant, and one that I really wanted to highlight for you, was unintentional injury. It was associated with both of the exposures that we measured, nearly fourfold for people who for communities that mentioned that they had seen unusual weather over the past 30 days compared to those who hadn't, and nearly fivefold for those who changed travel plans in communities compared to those who hadn't. So rather significant findings, I would say. What did we do with this? Well, we took these data back to the communities. We developed these large posters that you can see here. Thank you very much. And they were huge. They're about 6 feet long. And we placed them on the walls of the tribal centers, and we walked through these data we just presented. On the far left, we had the data. On the far right, we had some of the health outcomes that we just described to you. And in the middle, we had what we knew from the survey data in terms of changes in their diet, changes in plant and animal behaviors, those kinds of things. So after presenting this to the community, what we would do is we would drop a plain white piece of paper or plastic over the middle of that poster, and we'd ask them to draw lines. You get up here with this pen and mark a line connecting this exposure to this outcome, and then explain it to us. What happened there? Why did that happen? And in so doing, they were able to describe to us what might be some of the bases for causality. Right? So association does not imply causation, but the members of these communities can tell us why it might be causative. And the reason that we wanted to collect these data is so we could help them to determine how best to adapt to these challenges. So as a consequence of this elicitation exercise, we developed a set of interventions. The community members asked us to provide them with information that would help them to recognize and respond to challenges that led to injury primarily. And so every day, in fact, I'm just receiving them now, it's the morning in Alaska, so we're sending them out right now. Every day we send out warnings about weather events, ice events, dust events, fire events in our regions to all of our local community observers. And then they provide that information to their neighbors and to their family. And we're doing this on a daily basis, but what's most important is we're providing links. So you can see here we provided them with a link to the State of Alaska's Department of Health and Social Services regarding a PSP outbreak. And on the right side, on air quality. So they're beginning to recognize, okay, so these things actually exist. There is some help, there is some information for us that we could use. So hopefully, once this project comes to an end, they'll still be able to participate in these kinds of informed decision-making processes. So in conclusion, environmental changes are definitely occurring in the state of Alaska in each of the three regions. That community-based sentinel surveillance systems represent an effective strategy for tracking those events and their associated health risks. That preference elicitation exercises can engage and inform community residents in the development of adaptive responses. And that ultimately a multidisciplinary design combining public health and social scientific methods are necessary to engage and inform community residents. And I would just like to thank the people of Alaska, specifically our communities, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention who funded this work, the community organizers who are still participating in this work today, as well as our office staff. And for those of you who have any questions or you want to get in contact with me later, here's my contact information. I'd be happy to talk about it. Thank you very much for your attention.